can't even sink or swim. We've got too many holes in the ozone. Too much sunshine gets in. We've got too many people not thinking. Nobody but themselves. People we don't get to move on. We're living a living hell. We'll be drowning in some sorrows. If no one's got the guts to turn the tide.
Such has been the development of international bankers that they can no longer be regarded in their professional capacity as the nationals of any country, entitled to do business under their own government supervision exclusively. They are really world citizens with worldwide interests, and as such ought to be made amenable to some form of supranational control. George Petullo, Saturday Evening Post. A long time ago. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, and to all the freedom-loving Christians and patriots all across this republic and around the world, we bid you welcome this evening to another hour of Perspectives on America, specifically the fourth and final installment of our series, The Mask of Demetrios, entitled Checkmate. Do join us in our chat room if you're online with us tonight at www.federalobserver.com. As we record this final installment, the G8 conference outside of Atlanta, Georgia, or outside of Georgia on Sea Island, I believe it was, has come to a conclusion. Once again, Georgia fits into the time scheme, the frame, where many of the problems as related to the Federal Reserve Bank began. At Jekyll Island, also off the coast of Georgia. Let us continue with our saga. Not only did the Jewish financial firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company use far-sighted prudence in splitting its political support, one Warburg supporting Wilson, another Warburg supporting Taft, and an unnamed member of the firm supporting Roosevelt all at one time, as Paul Warburg has testified, but it split its activities in several other ways as well. The international interests of the Jews comprising this firm were worthy of note. The influence which forced the United States to repudiate a commercial treaty with Russia while Russia was a friendly country in 1911, and thus to compel all business between the United States and Russia to pass through German Jewish hands, was generated by Jacob H. Schiff. Russia seems to have been the country on which he chose to focus his activities. The full story was told on January 15, 1921, in a column entitled Taft Once Tried to Resist the Jews and Failed. And that will soon be published in its entirety in the library of the Federal Observer. Mr. Schiff's activity consisted in forcing the Congress of the United States to do a thing that was repugnant to the reason and conscience of President Taft, and which he personally refused to do or to recommend. Schiff left the White House in great anger with the threat, "This means war!" It did not mean as much war as it might have, for President Taft acquiesced gracefully in the Jewish victory and was later extremely laudatory of them on the public platform. Mr. Schiff's firm also helped finance the Japanese war against Russia, and in return desired Japan as a Jewish ally. Well, the wily Japs, however, saw the game and kept their relations with Mr. Schiff to purely business matters, which fact is well worth bearing in mind when reading the widespread propaganda for war with Japan that long ago. If you would have given particular attention at that time, you would have observed the same interests which are engaged in most loudly defending the Jew as most active in spreading anti-Japanese sentiments in this nation. Now, the Japanese war with Russia, however, enabled Schiff to advance his plan to undermine the Russian Empire, as it has now been accomplished by Jewish Bolshevism. With funds provided by him, the basic principles of what became known as Bolshevism were sown among the Russian prisoners of war in Japan, who were sent back as apostles of destruction. And then, of course, followed the horrible murder of Nicholas Romanov, Tsar of Russia, with his wife, his crippled son, and his young daughters, the full tale of which had subsequently been told by the Jew who managed the crime. For the part he played in destroying Russia, Mr. Schiff was wildly hailed in New York the night the news came that the emperor had abdicated. And meanwhile, the Jew who was to take the Tsar's job, as the common New York ghetto phrase ran, weeks before the event, by the way, had left New York to be in waiting. This Jew was passed out of the United States at the request of a very high American personage whose subservience to the Jews was one of the marvels of the past 7 years. Halted by the British, this Jew was released from their toils at the request of a very high American personage, and thus the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the program of which was made in America, was set in operation without a hitch. This whole firm is German-Jewish, its members having originated in Germany. It had German connections. How far it maintained those connections through all subsequent events, my friends, is a separate question altogether. Mr. Otto Kahn's allotted portion of the world seemed to be Great Britain and France. Now, Mr. Kahn was of German origin, and like the rest of his firm, but he had not publicly shown such concern for Germany as had other members. Schiff was once very active for the settlement of a peace on the basis of a victorious Germany. Mr. Paul M. Warburg also had interests, discussion of which is postponed for the present. But Mr. Kahn succeeded, through the connivance of American authority and the excessive repression of the newspapers, in conveying the impression that by some species of occult separatism that he was not German-minded. And therefore Mr. Kahn flitted lightly everywhere, except Germany. He was sufficiently French to be able to tell in the first column on the first page of Le Matin on what terms America would do business with Europe, and he spoke as one having authority. He was sufficiently British to have thought of standing for the British Parliament when an unfortunate event made it necessary for him to remain in the United States. Mr. Kahn sometimes flitted farther east into the more Jewish portions of Europe, and his comings and goings were marked by certain changes with which his name remained most ostentatiously disconnected. Mr. Kahn, you see, had been telling France on what terms the United States would help her, there apparently being no other spokesman. Mr. Kahn's word was accepted as authority. France was and still is one of the most Judaized countries in the world, the haunt of international Jewish financiers who exercise their power, thus saving France the trouble of passing laws, to keep the emigrant Jew out of France. so that France presented the spectacle of being Judaized by Jewish finance and not by immigrant Semitic hordes, and is thus a fit platform from which Mr. Otto Hermann Kahn was able to utter his pronouncements. In his final declaration to France, Kahn prepared her to expect little by stating that America is a country of immense resources, but the actual money which the people have at their disposal is comparatively limited. Well, true enough. You see, it was a member of Mr. Kahn's firm who invented a monetary system which was promised to keep money in more equal relation to wealth. But as he went on telling what America would and would not do, the American people, of course, knowing nothing about it, Kahn discovered with great enthusiasm a place where he thought American capital could be placed, namely, in the development of the vast and immensely rich colonial empire of France. And pray, where is that? Any Frenchman would tell you, in Syria. Syria? Ha ha! That part of the East where the natives are loudly complaining that the Jews are driving them out contrary to every written and moral law. Now, my friends, if you recall from our earlier series, All the King's Men, once the Roosevelt gang had pirated the gold away from the American people some 20 years after our current story, where was much of that gold shipped to? The answer is France. The Jewish powers had already succeeded in getting French troops over there. Bad blood had been caused between France and Great Britain. The Jews on both sides were playing for the middle. And here is Mr. Otto Kahn himself pledging American capital to the development of the French colonial empire. Talk to any Syrian or a descendant of a Syrian who lived back then who knew his country's status. And he would interpret Mr. Kahn's words very vividly. One of the nicest bits of work Kahn had done was to denounce pro-German propaganda, which he said had exasperated Americans in favor of France. Next to committing the United States to an undying admiration for Briand, this was really his finest bit, especially with partner Paul Warburg playing the German sympathy string. It was a great international orchestra, this Jewish financial firm. It could play the Star-Spangled Banner, Die Wacht am Rhein and Marseille, and God Save the King, in one harmonious rendering, paying obsequious attention to the prejudices of each. And next come the Warburgs, their interest, of course, in Germany. Paul stated in his testimony given at the beginning of the World War, that's World War I, that he had interest in Homburg and would dispose of them. The war came on. The Jewish government in the United States was augmented. Mr. Warburg was no mean figure, as previous commentaries have shown. The Warburgs, you see, are number three, or they are three in number, I'm sorry. Felix M. is the other one in America. He appeared but slightly in public affairs, although he was a member of the American Jewish Committee and of the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company. His retiring habit, however, did not argue lack of consequence. He was of sufficient consequence, Jewishly, to have bestowed upon him a sort of honorary rabbinical degree of Haber, which entitled him to be known as Haber Rabbi Baruch Ben Moshe. He was the only Jew at that time in America upon whom the title had ever been conferred. Now, Max Warburg represented the family in its native land, Germany. Max had as much to do with the German war government as his family and financial colleagues in America had to do with the United States war government, and has been recounted in the press the world over. The brother from America and the brother from Germany both met at Paris as government representatives in determining the peace, something we've commented on in this program for many, many years, my friends. There were so many Jews in the German delegation that it was known by the term of kosher, also as the Warburg delegation. And there were so many Jews in the American delegation that the delegates from the minor countries of Europe looked upon the United States as a Jewish country, which through unheard-of generosity had elected a non-Jew as its president. Now, Max Warburg is an interesting character, also as regards the establishment of Bolshevism in Russia. You see, the Jews had several objectives in the war, and one of those objectives was to get Russia. To this end, the German Jews worked very assiduously. Because Russia was a member of the Allies, the work of German Jews was made the easier. But the fact that Russia was an ally made no difference with the Jews who were resident in Allied countries. Win or lose, Russia must be destroyed was their motto. It was the testimony of history that it was not so much the German military prowess as the Jewish intrigue that accomplished the downfall of that empire. Now, in his work, Warburg was a factor. His bank was noted in a dispatch published by the United States government as being one whence funds were forwarded to Trotsky for use in destroying Russia. Always against Russia, not for German reasons, but for Jewish reasons, which in this particular instance coincided. Warburg and Trotsky against Russia. Poor John Spargo, who should have known better, denied all of this, of course, while every American who came back from Russia, even those who went over there pro-Bolshevik, yes, and returned Jews themselves, proclaimed it. The crushing fact was, my friends, is that Bolshevism was not only Jewish in Russia and in America, but it was Jewish in the higher regions of Jewry, where better things ought to exist. Take Walter Rathenau, a German Jew on the plain of the Warburgs. Rathenau was the inventor of the Bolshevik system of centralization of industry, material, and money. The Soviet government asked Rathenau directly for the plans and received them directly from him. Max Warburg's bank held the money. Walter Rathenau's mind held the plans, which makes it a pertinent question. If Bolshevism could be so Jewish outside of Russia, what hindered it from being Jewish inside of Russia? It is a most significant fact that is in Washington, the most constant and privileged visitors to the White House were Jews back in those days. And so in Berlin, the only private telephone wire to the Kaiser was owned by Walter Rathenau. Not even the Crown Prince could reach the Kaiser except through the ordinary telephone connections. It was the same in London. It was the same in Paris. It was the same in Petrograd. In Russia, which so persecuted the race that controlled it then and controls it now. Now, this sketchy outline of the internationalism of the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company is not offered as the result of keen research, for the facts are found on the very surface of the matter for anyone to see, my friends. But what is revealed by research is this. Whether Schiff's interest in Russia had underground features which affected the welfare of nations, whether Kahn's fitting missions here and there, which he made with great freedom during the war, were wholly taken up with the business announced in the public notices, and whether Mr. Warburg, whose interest in Germany had not abated, to judge from his recent utterances at that time, specifically those before Congress, was able to retain complete neutrality of mind during the war? These, my friends, are questions of value. And obviously they're not easy to answer, but they can be answered. You see, it was a family enterprise, this international campaign. Jacob Schiff swore to destroy Russia. Paul M. Warburg was his brother-in-law. Felix Warburg, his son-in-law. Max Warburg of Hamburg, banker of the Bolsheviks, was thus the brother-in-law to Jacob Schiff's wife and daughter. I just openly call it financial incest. Speaking of the far-sighted manner in which the House of Kuhn Loeb & Company disposes itself over world affairs, there is also the curious fact that in this Jewish firm is one who goes to a Christian church, or who went to a Christian church, a most heinous thing for a Jew to do. Split three ways in American politics, and as many ways as international matters required, we found that this firm had split two ways with regard to religion. Kahn professed, at least attended, a Christian church and was accounted an adherent of it. And yet he was not ostracized. His name was not taboo. The Jews did not curse him. He was not denounced as a renegade. The Jews had not buried him out of mind as they do others who desert the faith. And all of this presents a strange situation when it is considered. Not to recount again the horror and reprehension and active antagonism with which Jews view such a desertion. Suffice it to say there was no greater marvel than that of Jacob H. Schiff retaining in the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company a renegade Jew. He could not have done it. Every fiber of his intensely Jewish nature would have rebelled against it, and yet there it was. Now, without going further into this ingenious system of covering all vital points from one center, enough has been said to show one busy Jewish financial firm with which political matters, national and international, was almost a profession. The family of Warburg high in the controlling group of two countries, and enemy countries at that. The family of Warburg high in the negotiations of world peace and the discussions of a League of Nations, ultimately becoming the United Nations. The family of Warburg advising the world from both sides of the earth what to do next. It was probably with more reason than the general public surmised that a New York paper printed during the peace conference at the end of World War I an article entitled, Watch the Warburgs. Watch the Warburgs. The fact seems to be that, as Mr. Petullo is quoted as saying at the opening of this program today, the international financiers had been so engrossed in world money that the sense of national responsibility sometimes became blurred in their minds. They desired everything. War. Negotiations. Peace. All to be conducted in such a way as to react favorably on the money market. For that, you see, is their market. Money is what they buy and sell. And because money has no fixed price, it is a market which offers the widest opportunity for the trickster and swindler. One cannot play such tricks with stone or corn or metals, but with money as the commodity, everything is possible. You see, Warburg was very much interested about the treatment to be accorded foreign securities in the following years. Readers of daily newspapers back then recalled that recently a demand, back at that time, demand had been made for the gold in the Reichsbank, which was resisted on the ground that the Reichsbank, although the central bank of Germany, was really a private concern, just as Paul Warburg said it was, and just as he had insisted that our own Federal Reserve System should be a private concern, and of course it is. There is far-sighted wisdom in that with a view to possible defeat in war, don't you think? Warburg was apparently quite disapproving of the treatment accorded alien enemy property by some countries. He quoted a French banker throughout, nationality not stated, and he drove home his point. The French banker used as an illustration a possible war between England and France. And that was back in when, 1920 or thereabouts? And said that the bankers in each country would proceed to withdraw their mutual balances and securities for fear of confiscation, and that such a course would precipitate a panic. To which Mr. Warburg added, I think that our bankers ought to carefully study this very serious question. We have nothing to gain and much to lose by joining a policy of disregarding the rights of private property. We shall probably, in the course of time, become the largest owners of foreign securities and properties, which would become endangered in case we were drawn into war. To me, however, it is of greater interest that nothing could be done that might stand in the way of making the United States the gold reserve country of the world.
Well, such talk passed with too little scrutiny. It bore a strong reflection of historic events, which should not have been overlooked. Moreover, it represented or presented a grandiose vision, which was supposed to command instant agreement because of its appeal to superficial national pride and selfish ambition. If what Warburg said was an intimation that the international Jews were planning to move their money market to the United States, it was safe to say that the United States did not want it, or at least should not have wanted it. We had the warning of history as to what this would mean. It meant that in turn Spain, Venice, Great Britain, or Germany received the blame and suspicion of the world for what the Jewish financiers had done. It is a most important consideration that most of the national animosities that existed then, as do today, arose out of resentment against what the Jewish money power had done under the camouflage of national names. I mean, you can hear it throughout history. Read it. The British did that. The Germans did that. But you see, it was not the British that did it, nor the Germans that did it, nor the Iraqis that did it, nor Saddam Hussein or the Ayatollah Khomeini. It was the international Jew who did it. The nations being but the marked spaces on their checkerboard, you see. Today, around the world, the blaming word is this. But the United States did it. If it were not for the United States, the world would be in better shape. The Americans are a sordid, greedy, cruel people. And why is that, my friends? Because the Jewish money power is largely centered here and is making money out of both our immunity and Europe and the Middle East distress this very day. They play one against the other, and because so many of the so-called American businessmen abroad today are not Americans at all, they are Jews, and in many cases as misrepresentative of their own race as they are of the Americans. The United States does not want the transfer of all Judean to this soil. We do not desire to stand as a gold god above the nations. We would serve the nations and we would protect them, but we would do both in the basis of real values, not in the name or under the sign of gold. On the other hand, Mr. Warburg recited pitiful facts about Germany in order to raise sympathy for her, and on the other hand, he stimulated the gold lust of the United States back then. The plight of Germany was entirely due to the forces from which the United States had only narrowly escaped. And to hearken to international Jewish plans for the rehabilitation of Germany was to be in danger of approving plans which would fasten Jewish domination more strongly on that unhappy country than it is right now. Right now, of course, being back in the late 19-teens and early 20s. And as history has proven, Germany paid dearly for her Jews. The Warburg voice that spoke for her would seem indeed to be the voice of Jacob, but the hand that proposed financial dealings was that of Esau. The internationalism of the Warburgs was no longer in doubt. It cannot be denied as we look back over this last nearly 100 years of history. Felix Warburg hung on to the Hamburg connection longer than did Paul, but the breakage of either was probably perfunctory. At the same time that Felix left the Hamburg firm of his brother, Max, a Mr. Stern also left the Frankfurt firm of Stern, and both became very active on the Allies' side, taking sides against the German nation as lustily as anyone could. Impossible, say those who fancy that a German Jew is a German. Not at all impossible. You see, the Jews' loyalty is to the Jewish nation, whatever and wherever that may happen to be. What the Jew himself refers to as his cover nationality may count or not as he himself elects. Now, that statement is always met with frothing wrath by the Jews, Gentile fronts in the purchased pro-Jewish press. But let me share with you an example. Do you recall the Beast of Berlin, that lurid piece of war propaganda? Very few of you have probably ever read or heard of it. Well, you did not know, perhaps, that its producer was a German Jew named Karl Lemley. His German birth did not prevent him making money out of his film. His film did not prevent him annually going back in state to his birthplace. In the early 1920s, he went accomplished by Abe Stern, his treasurer, Lee Kolmar, his director, and Harry Reichenbach, a list of names duplicable in any movie group. Karl Lemley, a great filmmaker in his day. Messrs. Stern and Warburg of Frankfurt and Hamburg, respectively, and away from home perhaps only temporarily, were not concerned about the fate of the Huns, but they were immensely concerned about the fate of Jewish money power in Germany. And to indicate how blind the public had been to the inter-allied Jewish character of much of the world's important international financial activity, not only then, but as they are to this very day, let me share this quote from you from a publication entitled Living Age. It said, according to the Svensk Handelsstidning, the recent American loan back then of $5 million to Norway was really the outcome of an agreement between the Hamburg firm of Warburg & Company and the New York bankers Kuhn and Loeb. Now remember, they were all interrelated by marriage and otherwise. It is regarded, the article continued, as a significant sign of the times that a German firm should be responsible for an American loan to a neutral company or country. The conditions subject to which this money was borrowed are not regarded as very favorable to Norway, and no marked effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries has followed. My friends, note, in the light of all statements made about Kuhn Loeb & Company and the Warburgs in particular, the assumption in the above quotation, that which we have just shared with you, that the transaction was really between a German and an American firm. It was principally an arrangement between the Warburgs themselves in family council. But the loan passed in Norway as an American loan, and the fact that the terms of the loan were not regarded as very favorable to Norway will react upon Scandinavian opinion of that country. It goes without saying that, quote, no market effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries had followed, end quote. For that, you see, would not be the objective of such a loan. The dislocation of exchange is not unprofitable. It would be most interesting to know in how far Kuhn Loeb & Company had endeavored to readjust the rate of exchange. Now, during the war, Kuhn Loeb & Company, we're still talking World War I here. We haven't even gotten to World War II. And in this program, we're not going to. During the war, Kuhn Loeb & Company made a loan to the city of Paris. Considerable German comment was occasioned by this, naturally. And it's very well worthy of record that in the city of Hamburg, where Max Warburg did his business, the chief of police issued this order. First a mention in the press of loans made by the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company to the city of Paris, and unfavorable comments thereon are verboten. What I share with you now is vouched for as reliable. And if in one or two minor details it does not represent the exact fact, it is a trustworthy illustration of how certain things were done. A Jewish international banking corporation bought up the mining and other similar concessions of Yugoslavia. And consequently, the policy pushed at the peace conference was that which was most convenient for that group. An understanding on the Fiume question was in progress between Wilson and Nitti. Certain concessions had been agreed upon, and Wilson was willing to negotiate when Oscar Strauss, one of the Warburgs, appeared on the scene. Wilson changed his attitude overnight and afterward insisted on the Yugoslavian solution of the problem. The way in which concessions had been bought through that territory was a disgrace, and observers expected that it would play an important part at the peace conference. The financiers, my friends, were not the only international Jews in the world. The revolutionary Jews of all countries and none are international as well. They have seized upon the idea of Christian internationalism, which meant amity between nations, and they have used it as a weapon with which to weaken nationality. They know as well as anyone that there can be no internationalism except on the basis of strong nationalism. But they count on cover words to advance their plan. Enough transpired between the lower and higher Jewish groups of every large center of finance during the war to render it imperative that Jewry confess, repent, and repudiate the madness that has ruled it, or else boldly assert and espouse it before the world. Certainly enough has transpired to render it desirable that the American people to this day look again into the purposes of those Jews who were instrumental in reorganizing our financial system at a most critical time in the world's history. Max Warburg was apparently strong enough to suppress German discussion of his brother's activity in America. And yet the international Jewish banker who has no country but plays them all against one another, and the international Jewish proletariat that roams from land to land in search of a peculiar type of economic opportunity are not figments of the imagination except to the non-Jew who prefers a lazy laxity of mind. Of these classes of Jews, one or both are at the heart of the problems that disturb the world to this very day. The immigration problem is Jewish. The money question is Jewish. The tie-up of world politics is Jewish. The terms of peace treaties are Jewish. The diplomacy of the world is Jewish. And the moral question in movies and the theaters and the entertainment industry across the board is Jewish. These facts are unfortunate as well as unpleasant for the Jew, and it is squarely up to him to deal with the facts and not waste time in trying to destroy those who define the facts. These facts are interpreted by the Jew and the anti-Semite with strange extremes of blindness. The Jew, you see, never gets the world's point of view at all. He always gets the anti-Semite's point of view, and the anti-Semite is equally at fault in always getting the Jew's point of view. And to say that the immigration problem is Jewish does not mean that Jews must be prohibited entry into any country. It means that they must become rooted to a country in loyal citizenship, as no doubt some are, and as no doubt most are not. To say that the money question is Jewish does not mean that Jews must get out of finance. It means that they must rid finance of the Jewish idea, which has always been to use money to get a stranglehold on men and business concerns instead of using finance to help general business. And to say that the tie-up of world politics is Jewish does not mean that Jews, as human beings, are to be denied a voice in affairs. It means that they must give up trying to make the world revolve around the Jewish nation as its axis. It is not the true Jewishness of the Jew, nor yet the nationalism of the Jew that is on trial, but his anti-national internationalism. A true Mosaic Jew, not a Talmud Jew, would be a good citizen. A nationalist Jew would at least be logical, but an international Jew has proved an abomination because his internationalism is focused on his own racial nationalism, which in turn is founded on his ingrained belief that the rest of humanity is inferior to him and by right his prey. Jewish leaders may indulge in all the platitudes they possess. The fact which they cannot deny is that the Jew has for centuries regarded the Goyim as beneath him and legitimately his spoil. The internationalism of the Jew is confessed everywhere by him. Listen to a German banker. Imagine the slow, oily voice in which he might have said it. We are international bankers. Germany lost the war? What of it? That is an affair of the army. We are international bankers. And that, you see, my friends, has been the attitude of every international Jewish banker during war. The nation's in strife, what of it? It was like a Dempsey-Carpentier bout in Jersey, or a baseball game in Chicago, an affair of the fighters. But we are international bankers. A nation is being hamstrung by artificial exchange rates, another by the sucking of money out of its channels of trade. What of it to the international banker? He has his own game to play, you see. Hard times bring more plums tumbling off the tree into the baskets of the international bankers than does any other kind of time. War and panics are the Jewish international bankers' harvests. Citizens wake up with a start to find that even the white nations are hardly allowed to see each other nowadays, except through Jewish eyes. And when the United States supposedly speaks to France, through whom does she speak? All that France saw at that time in history was Otto H. Kahn, and today it's none other than Alan Greenspan. Lord knows it should not be George W. Bush. The business of the peace conferences over the years has been done by Jews. Has it come to a point where international diplomacy is to become a Jewish monopoly as well? Must the special conversations between France, Britain, the United States, Russia, and all the other nations of the world be held through Jewish interpreters while Anglo-Saxons and true Frenchmen do the routine embassy work? Or shall it be possible for the non-Jewish nations to see one another occasionally through non-Jewish representatives? Internationalism, my friends, is not a Jewish conviction, but a Jewish business device. It is most profitable. In diplomacy and at the immigration station, internationalism pays. Jews interpret nation to nation on the high rights of special conversations between governments. Jewish interpreters swarm at the ports of every country as well, where the poor swarm in. And it was stated in the House of Lords at one time that most of the trouble in Palestine was caused by Jewish interpreters, and it was charged that the Jewish administration added an extra language to the official list in order to make Jewish interpreters indispensable. go through the government of the United States to this very day, where the income tax secrets are kept, where the Federal Reserve secrets are kept, where the State Department secrets are kept, and you will find Jews sitting at the very spot where international Jewry desires them to sit and where nothing is kept from their knowledge. Go abroad, come back to your country, and a Jew will open the gate to let you in or close it to keep you out as he chooses.
Will you be going to Detroit while you're here?
I may go to Detroit.
Well, you go and tell him a Jew lets you into the country.
What the visitor replied is known, but had better not be quoted. The American Jewish Committee might shriek that the people were being incited to pogroms. The incident that I've just described is but a sample of what is occurring each and every day. The truth about the Jewish question in the United States is perhaps the one form of truth that cannot be indiscriminately told. The international bankers regard themselves as in similar fashion, letting the nations do this or that, regarding the nations not as fatherlands, but as customers, and as customers in the Jewish sense. If an army wins or loses, if a government succeeds or fails, what of it? That is their affair. They are international bankers. Won't we win? Whoever loses. For international Jewish bankers, war, you see, is never over. The period of actual hostilities and the emergencies of the nations are but the opening of a trade. The ready cash is skimmed in then, all the cash the world had. True, some of it had to be distributed among the people as war waged and bonuses. War wages and bonuses in order to keep the struggle going, but this was soon recovered through the means of high prices, artificial scarcities, and the orgy of extravagance deliberately organized and stimulated among the people, just as we face with our outrageous price of a gallon of gasoline today. The phase was over. The money once again disappeared. Is there any more tragic joke than that diligently disseminated in this country? The United States has more gold than any country in the world, the question was. And the next question was, where is it? How long since you've seen a piece of gold? Where is all the gold? Is it locked up in the treasury of the United States government? Why, that government's in debt, desperately trying to economize, cannot pay a soldier a decent, livable wage because the finances of the country cannot stand it. Where is the gold? Well, it may be in the United States, but ladies and gentlemen, it no longer belongs to the United States. The American farmer and those American industries which were not wise to the tricks of international Jewish bankers and who were nipped by small loans, they're all wondering where the money is. The Jewish international banking system may be easily described. First, there is the International Jewish Headquarters. That was in Germany. It had ramifications in Russia, Italy, France, Great Britain, and South American states. Germany and Russia were the two countries scheduled for punishment by the international Jewish bankers because those two countries were most aware of the Jew. They have been punished. The job is done. Many times over since the 1920s. Jewish political headquarters, as related to the internal affairs of the Jews, was also located in Germany, but the headquarters dealing with the Goyim was in France. Statements have been made that the political center of Jewry had been transported to the United States, but those statements had been made by American Jews, whose wish may have been further to the thought. And during the Wilson administration, it was possible for a Jew to think and to hope this, but affairs had changed. The ousting of American Jews from the Zionist movement at the behest of Eastern Jews indicates that if the political center of the world Jewry had shifted to the United States, the power is still in the hands of aliens resident here. The center is still in Jewry. The United States was merely a square on Jewry's world checkerboard. But whatever and wherever the financial and political world centers may be, each country is separately handled. In every country, the United States, Mexico, the republics of South America, in France, England, Italy, Germany, Austria, yes, and even in Japan, there's an international Jewish banking firm which stands at the head of the group for that country. And thus the chief Jewish firm in the United States was Kuhn Loeb & Company, of which one of the members was Paul M. Warburg, brother of M. Warburg & Company of Hamburg, and another member of which was Otto H. Kahn, resident successfully of Germany, Great Britain, and the United States, and self-appointed financial spokesman for the United States to France and Great Britain. Great Britain and France seldom saw a special American spokesman who was not a Jew. Maybe the reason why they reciprocate by sending Jews to us, thinking perhaps that maybe we prefer them. Warburg was the inventor, the perfecter, and director of the Federal Reserve System of the United States. He has not been the only Jew in the Federal Reserve System, but he was the chief Jew there at that time. His mind counted for a great deal. There were others in the war government, of course, Bernard Baruch, Eugene Meyer, Jr., Hoover's Regiment of Jews, Felix Frankfurter, Julius Rosenwald, hundreds of them, and everywhere. But the financial group alone had only at that time recently been receiving our attention. And they were not so notably successful in getting the country out of financial difficulty as they were in other lines of effort. The Federal Reserve System has, in my estimation, proven to be a bad system, in spite of the fact that it yields government monetary functions to private financial corporations, but there are all sorts of testimony that it has been badly manipulated. Warburg, the listener will remember, spoke about certain things being overcome in an administrative way, showing that there was a certain amount of play or loose motion in the system which could be manipulated either way, much as Greenspan does to this very day. The fact remains that the country went swimmingly through several wars by reason of the assistance of the system and came very lamely through the peace processes as the result of the hindrance of the same system. Warburg, whose name was so prominently connected with the advertisement of the glory of the system, must also stand being mentioned in connection with the criticism. Whatever money we were said to have as the per capita in the United States, it was a false statement. The money per capita should always be figured on the basis of money in circulation. The statistical per capita is not always in circulation, less than half of it, as a rule. The rest is being, shall we say, juggled. Whatever the gold in the country, the wealth is still greater. There's more wealth in the United States than there is gold in the world. At one time, 1 year's products of the farms of the United States exceeded in money value all the gold in the world. And yet, under our present system, the burgeoning bulk of the country's wealth must pass through the narrow neck of money. There's more wealth than there is money. There's more money than there is gold. Money exists at the pleasure of gold. Wealth moves at the pleasure of money. Whoever sits at the neck of money, opening or closing as he will, controls the movement of the world's wealth, and the world's prosperity depends on the movement of that wealth. When wealth stands still and does not pass from hand to hand, the world's circulation has ceased. The world becomes economically sick. The scarcity of cash in hand has led to credit. Credit, my friends, is a form of barter. It's a form of dealing by which many transactions are carried on, only the final one being cleared in money. It's a device which has its dangers, in spite of the efforts of apologists to exploit its advantages. But one thing the system of credit indubitably does, it allows the money masters to hang on to the cash. And when the world is caught, it's going to be caught with paper, not with cash. The cash is always in the hands of those who extol the advantage of the credit system. Who holds money holds power and will hold it until real barter or real money comes into fashion once again. From 1919 to 1920, according to one of the best monetary authorities in the United States, the total shrinkage in values of the products of our fields and mines and factories and mills and forests represented a sum greater than the total supply of gold in the world. But people say, well, the prices were too high. Certainly they were too high. But who and what made them too high? It was the generosity with which money was supplied by the private Federal Reserve System. There was plenty of money. And people say, well, the shrinkage is only in paper values. The real value of the product is still there. Well, certainly. Well, when you live under a system in which real value and money value are so intimately intertwined that it affects your bread and butter, the tenure of your farm, and the steadiness of your job, it's pretty damn hard to separate the two, isn't it? And moreover, when your prosperity was due to the readiness of a group of men to let out money, and your adversity is due to the unwillingness of the same group, and your own welfare and your country's welfare is thus seesawed up and down without any reference to natural law, but solely upon determinations taken in committee rooms, you naturally inquire,
Who is doing this? Where is all this money gone? Who is holding it? Here is the wealth of the country. Here is the need of the country. Where is the money to transfer the wealth to the need? Every condition remains as it was, except money. Oh, we have a Federal Reserve System which initially benefited by the assistance of its perfecter and director, Paul M. Warburg, and continues to do so under the guiding hand of Mr. Greenspan, and will no doubt be inherited by another of his kind. And what is the condition of the United States? What will the future hold? Some of the biggest industrial institutions in the country are now in the hands of creditors' committees. In the late 1980s, farmers being sold out by the hundreds, if not thousands. Many lines of business, airlines, storekeeping, manufacturing, agriculture, are in depression. Why? For lack of money. No. Real money. And where is the money? This is a country that is supposed to be the financial center of the world. Where is the money? It's in New York. The Federal Reserve System, which Mr. Warburg desired to head up in one central bank, has turned out that way. The money is in New York. The money is in New York. Go out through the agricultural states and you will not find it. Go into the districts of silent factories and you will not find it. It's in New York. The Warburg / Greenspan Federal Reserve has deflated the country. A system that was intended to equalize the ups and downs of financial weather has been used in an administrative way to deplete the country of real money. The Federal Reserve has been manipulated, as was Warburg's vision. It has not been a Federal Reserve. It has been a private reserve. It has been operated in the interest of bankers and not of everyone in general. Capable of being used to carry the country gradually back to a natural flow of business and to a natural flow of prices. It was used to bludgeon business at a critical time and to bludgeon it in such a way that money lenders profited when producers suffered. If that is the fact, there is no American banker but will say that the method was wrong. Economically wrong, logically wrong, commercially wrong, if not criminally wrong. The day, my friends, the Federal Reserve boasts of its own reserve as if it were a sign of national economic health. And with the country struggling to live, the Federal Reserve ought to be low, not high. The high which the reserve has reached is a measure of the depth of the country's continued manipulation and depression. If the Federal Reserve would let out a part of that flood of money, a high, real money we're talking about once again, a high financial authority suggests that less than 10% would do it. It would be like an infusion of blood into the nation's veins. Kuhn Loeb and Company, the Speyers, and the other Jewish money lenders had money for Mexico and Norway and Germany and Russia and all sorts of commercial companies being organized to do business overseas, and every bit of it is American money. And the Federal Reserve System has been badly misused, badly manipulated. The country continues to suffer from it. And still, the people know not what to do. Money is still a mystery to the American public. Banking is still sacrosanct. What would be perfectly apparent if done in ordinary business intercourse with a $5 bill is exceedingly complicated when the sum is $5 million or $5 billion or $5 trillion and the parties are one, country banks, two Federal Reserve banks, and three Wall Street speculative institutions, and yet they are only Tom, Dick, and Harry with a $5 bill after all. The matter is somewhat affected by the gags that are placed on many men competent to criticize. High officials are more or less tied up by campaign contributions in which all financial concerns have an interest. Legislative officials are, too many of them, indebted to these same interests. And a schedule of the private debts of some of the men who have aspired to the presidency in the last 8 years would be very illuminating. Almost as illuminating as a schedule of the names of Jews at whose homes they stayed while on journeys throughout the country. Men who are thus tied up with the present financial system cannot say what in their minds they know is right. It is all illustrated in the testimony once given by T. Cushing Daniel before a committee of Congress. It shows to what an extent the power of this private corporation called the central bank can reach. He stated thusly, "When going through the Bank of England, I presented a letter which I had from Secretary Hay.
And the official of the bank was very polite. He took me through the bank. And when we got back to the reception room, I asked him if he would allow me to put a few leading questions to him. He said he would. And I asked him if he would give me a statement of the Bank of England. "We do not issue statements," he said. "Does not the House of Parliament sometimes call on you for some statement as to the condition of the bank?" "No, sir. They do not call on us." "How is it that some of these revolutionists, so-called, do not get up on the House of Commons and raise the devil to know something about what is going on down here? That would be the condition in our country. Oh, most of them are large borrowers from the bank, and we have no difficulty with them." And at that point in time, nothing was received but absolute laughter. For money, some men will allow the innocent to hang. They will turn traitor. They will lie, cheat, steal, and they will kill. They appear brilliant, charming, and generous. Such are men as Demetrios. My friends, we reached the end of our series. In conception, it was originally to have been titled The Shadow Government of the United States. Need I say more? Recent headlines don't even begin to tell the real story of these diabolical people and their plans for the future America. I hope you've learned something out of this series. Is the story over? Absolutely not. And we will be here to continue to bring you more episodes of the truth and reality of international Jewish finance. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. It's the best of the free life behind us now. And are the good times really over for good? I wish Coke was still cola and a joint was a bad place to be. And it was back before Nixon lied to me. All on TV. Before microwave ovens, when a girl could still cook, still would. It's the best of the free life behind us now. Are the good times really over? Chance for the flag, the Liberty Bell. I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. Is the best of the free life behind us now? Are the good times really over for good? Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell. Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the Liberty Bell. Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that'll still last 10 years like they should. Best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
You can't handle the truth! You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.